And welcome into the Friday edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. What a week it was, right? Well, the Bucks made moves. Unfortunately, it was allegedly before they were allowed to make moves. That could wind up biting them in the rear end when all is said and done. We'll have that coming up. Also, a couple of big football games on tap. One intra-division, the other interconference. Both matchups are tough. The Badgers are at Northwestern on Saturday afternoon. The Packers are at Indianapolis on Sunday afternoon. We'll have a full preview of both of those contests here in a couple of minutes. Of course, you can find us on our social media channels, Instagram and Twitter, at Doug Russell Pod. Facebook and YouTube, search for the Doug Russell Podcast. And you can always email us at DougRussellPod@gmail.com. We have to start with the Bucks, right?
It's pretty much dead in the water. I mean, in theory, it can be salvaged, but the key ingredient was Ersan Ilyasova's $7 million salary. That had to be waived today. The Bucks waived him, so he's out. You can salvage it by trading Brook Lopez. They don't want to do that. And then there becomes like these incredibly complicated multiple sign-in trades that are too complex to even talk about. And yeah, it's a big blow to the Bucks. Bogdan Bogdanovic would have been a great fit there, a guy who can shoot and handle, take some of the ball handling pressure on Giannis. Great mid-range shooter, which is something they didn't really have in their arsenal other than Chris Middleton for late in games. And so now they're going to have to reset.
ESPN senior NBA writer Zach Lowe talking about the ill-fated Bogdan Bogdanovic trade. So how did all of this happen? Well, the Bucks and the Kings apparently had reached an agreement in principle early Tuesday on a sign and trade that would have brought Bogdanovic and Justin James to the Bucks. The Kings would have gotten Dante DiVincenzo, DJ Wilson, and Ersan Ilyasova. Now, Ilyasova has, of course, as you heard, been waived. This from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Bucks beat writer Matt Velasquez, quote, "Some believed Wednesday's revelations were all part of a larger cover-up. With the news of the sign-and-trade leaking on Tuesday, it raised the possibility of a tampering violation since teams aren't allowed to contact a free agent or his representative about any potential deals until free agency officially begins at 5 p.m. on Friday. That rule includes the Kings, who are not allowed to negotiate with Bogdanovic, even though he is their free agent. The Bucks waiving Ilyasova lends credence to the belief that Wednesday's revelations were not part of a smokescreen. Milwaukee, which is operating over the salary cap, doesn't have many players to trade, and including Ilyasova in the reported deal for Bogdanovic was a critical piece to making everything work." End quote. So how does all of this happen? The NBA's tampering rules are so specious that it's hard to take them seriously. The Bucks were fined $50,000 last year just for John Horst saying that they were going to offer Giannis the Supermax deal a year ago. Goes back to another question about what has transpired this week. How was it leaked? How did Bogdan Bogdanovic not give the okay if that's what was needed? Moreover, are other teams that covet Giannis and think they have now a real opportunity to lure him, are they the ones that blew this up? Now look, if the Bucks breached protocol and they knew what the rules were, it's hard to defend that, right? But all of these other teams, they themselves have engaged in the same thing for years. So now the question becomes, now what? The Bucks are over the salary cap. So the most that they can offer a free agent is the full mid-level exception, about $9.3 million. So even if he wanted to come to Milwaukee badly enough to leave tens of millions of dollars on the table, which he won't, the Kings, because the Bucks can only offer him about $9.3 million, the Kings are just going to match the offer sheet and keep him. So let's basically forget Bogdan Bogdanovic in a Bucks uniform, unless the Bucks, as Zach Lowe said, unless they're willing to trade Brook Lopez, which I doubt they would. And they had to waive Ersan Ilyasova because otherwise they were on the hook for $7 million. That deadline was Thursday, yesterday. I'll be honest, I almost forgot that Ersan was even still on the Bucks. So no, don't pay him $7 million if you're over the cap so he can just rot on the bench. One thing that is certain about this is that on some level, it was bungled. If it were kept private, if it weren't leaked, the Bucks may have gotten away without at least the public embarrassment of it. But now they have to wear it. The doomsday scenario is it might impact what Giannis ultimately decides. Because here's my doomsday scenario. Without Giannis Antetokounmpo, the Bucks are not close to being a contender. And I know that they're under pressure from ownership, from fans, and John Horst is feeling it right now. He's under pressure to make it work for Giannis, for him to want to stay in Milwaukee long term. But if this is what pushes him out the door, I've got to think that heads are going to roll. The franchise rests on Giannis Antetokounmpo's broad shoulders. If he's gone, Fiserv Forum will be a lovely but half-empty building until the next Giannis comes along in another 40 years. That's how important he is. That is how important it is to keep Giannis Antetokounmpo in Milwaukee. I've said this on the podcast. I've said this on the radio for years. Before Giannis even came to Milwaukee, what's holding the Bucks back? Why can't they emerge from irrelevancy, which, of course, in the last 2 or 3 years, they have? It's because they needed a little bit of luck. They needed to create some of their own luck, but they also needed some luck to fall their way. And Giannis Antetokounmpo was, and still is, hopefully for the long term, but who knows? He's that piece of luck. He's that stroke of luck that 14 other teams passed on. He's that stroke of luck that, you know what, maybe let's just make that flight over to Athens and scout this kid and see what some of this chatter is all about. 14 teams passed on Giannis Antetokounmpo in a terrible draft. There were 3 All-Stars from the 2013 NBA draft. Victor Oladipo, who was taken at number 2, Giannis at number 15, and Rudy Gobert, who was taken in the mid-20s. That's it. This was a wretched draft. Anthony Bennett was the number 1 overall pick. He was taken by Cleveland, and he was a complete bust. The Bucks got lucky. The Bucks needed to get lucky. The Bucks needed to have something finally go their way. Now, they haven't lived up to that promise in the last couple of years in the playoffs, getting run by Toronto 2 seasons ago in the Eastern Conference Finals, and then losing in the second round in the odd bubble created by COVID and resting in Orlando, but they were run by Miami, and credit to the Heat. They had a great run as well. They got to the NBA Finals before losing to the Lakers. But that's how important Giannis is. Do whatever you have to do to keep him. Just don't get caught cheating. And the NBA is looking into it right now. And I hope that there's nothing more that comes of it than just maybe they jumped the gun a little bit. Don't do it again. Because everybody has done it in the NBA. All right, moving along. The Brewers have a new general manager. No, David Stearns isn't going anywhere, but he's ceding his GM duties to assistant general manager Matt Arnold.
An extraordinarily well-deserved promotion. Matt's been an integral part of our organization for the past 5 years. One of the first moves, if not the first move I made when I got here, was to bring Matt on board, and he's been by my side ever since. He's been involved in every single aspect of our baseball operations group. He's been involved in every significant decision we've made.
David Stearns, who will now just hold the title of president of baseball operations. As for Matt Arnold, he'll likely be more front-facing, but I think that's about it. Arnold had interviewed for several GM openings around baseball, but hadn't been hired, so the Brewers decided to just promote him. I don't expect much to really change. Matt Arnold isn't going to trade Christian Yelich without David Stearns' approval, who frankly isn't going to trade Christian Yelich without Mark Adonasio's approval, so it's really basically business as usual, but good for Matt Arnold. He is a top-shelf baseball man. Congratulations to him. All right, let's get to some football. Saturday, it's the Badgers and the Wildcats.
A lot of respect for Fitz and their staff and their players and how they're playing this year. And you know, every game against them is a challenge. This year will be no different, but excited for a good week of preparation by our guys.
Wisconsin coach Paul Christ, his number one objective, trying to establish something against the stingy Northwestern defense, coached by defensive coordinator Mike Hankowitz.
He plays to his talent, and their players understand it. And they execute it. And I think when you look at the good defenses around the conference, you know, it's just that. It's guys that obviously well coached, but players understanding the scheme and going to play.
Still, Wisconsin's offense has been putting up big numbers in the 2 games they've been able to play so far this season. No matter.
You know, it was good for us just to get back to playing. You know, hopefully we can carry that forward and then we get our pad level down a little bit more and timing on different elements in the game. But it's nothing will be given against this defense. And then for a long time. They played really good defense, and they're playing excellent defense right now.
As for that Wildcats defense, they've been opportunistic to say the least. Quarterback Graham Mertz knows all about their average of 2 picks per game in 2020.
Like a lot of teams play pure progression and try to hit 1, 2, 3, and they do a great job of jacking it up and getting there where you can't get 3, and then you're like, oh, where am I going with it? And they kind of get guys to scramble right there. But on our end of it, we got to be really crisp with our read keys and our decisions. I think that for a quarterback, that's fun. So I can't wait for it.
And even when Northwestern isn't picking off passes, they're defending well against the home run ball too.
Their defense, they always got one little trick up their sleeve to kind of mess with our read keys. So just got to be ready to play the game and really see those. And when you get those, be able to react to it. But I'm confident in my ability, and I know I'm confident in the guys around me. And I know if I put up, they're going to go make a play. So I'm definitely excited for the challenge ahead of us. And I think the guys will be ready.
One of those guys, big tight end, Jake Ferguson.
I mean, I played him twice in my time here. We know they're smart guys, and we know it's going to be a fight. I mean, just got to lock in every play, have a really good prep this week, just make sure we're really clicking on this offensive side.
Joining me now here on the Doug Russell Podcast, he covers the Northwestern Wildcats for the Illinois Radio Network, where he serves as their sports director. We welcome in longtime friend Jason Gotch to the show. Jason, thanks for being here. Good to see you.
Doug, it's an honor. Glad to be a part of your new venture here. Honored to be on the program. And yeah, let's talk about who would have thought coming into the season that this would be the game of the week in the Big Ten, Wisconsin and Northwestern, maybe a game for the Big Ten West title. It should be a fun one in Evanston.
All right. You cover this Northwestern team. You, as I mentioned at the top, are a Northwestern Wildcat yourself. So the first question that I think not only I have, but a lot of folks around college football are asking themselves this week, is this Northwestern Wildcats team for real?
Very simple one-word answer, and I'll elaborate on it in a moment, Doug. Yes. Yes, the Northwestern Wildcats are for real, and there's a few big reasons for that. Number one, you'll see this on Saturday. Wisconsin fans will see this, win or lose. Northwestern is very good in the trenches on both sides of the ball. They got an experienced defense. Their front four is very good. Their front seven's very good. And they have an experienced offensive line. They can block in the run game. They can block in the pass game. And I've always been a believer, no matter when you're looking at an era of football, whether it's now pass-happy football here in 2020 like it's been for the last 10 or 15 years, or you go back to the old 3 yards in a cloud of dust days in the 60s and the 70s and even into the 80s, the Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler days of the Big Ten, or really any level of football, if you have good line play, you're going to be a pretty darn good team. You might not win a championship, but you're going to be a tough opponent each and every week for somebody. And that's what Northwestern is. They're a tough opponent. They're unbeaten. They've got good line play. And I'll throw something else out there for you, Doug. People might have thought I was crazy when I was on the radio or talking about Northwestern last year. They were, off the top of my head, I think they were 3-9. They won their final game against Illinois. They were bad on paper, but they really weren't that bad. The problem last year for Northwestern, the quarterback play was terrible. And that's an understatement. This year, they have Peyton Ramsey, the graduate transfer from Indiana. He played a lot of games for the Hoosiers in a starting role, coming off the bench. He knows the conference. Northwestern brings him in, and he's a guy who protects the ball pretty well. He can move around a little bit in the pocket. He can make plays. He's got the experience, like I said. So Northwestern wasn't bad last year. They had a pretty good running game. They're a really good defensive team, actually. Just couldn't get any offense going. Their offensive line was pretty good last year. Not great. Okay. It's better this year. But you throw Peyton Ramsey in there, all of a sudden you solve the most important need you had. You got good line play. This team's for real.
One of the things that I've observed in the game against Purdue last weekend is that for the first time, I really see Northwestern playing with a lot of up-tempo play on offense. How important is that to them establishing time of possession and establishing their will on the defense?
Yeah, there was a lot of more confidence because, again, it goes back to the quarterback position. They changed the offensive coordinator in the offseason, so they have a little bit more up-tempo that you said. And there's more confidence because you know your quarterback's going to protect the ball, make the plays he needs to make. And Drake Anderson's been a real good running back for them, filling in for Isaiah Bowser when he's been hurt this year. So they've got some depth at the running back position. They've been able to make plays. But you're right. The offense has been able to set the tone at times this year for Northwestern to play off their good defense to keep that going. playing, as opposed to last year when the defense would make play after play after play and the offense couldn't move the ball at all. So I think the up-tempo fits into what they're trying to do, where Ramsey can do a bunch of different things. Like I said, he's not a great running quarterback, but he can move around in the pocket. Anderson can move the chains on the ground. They can do things through the air. So, you saw it in the Purdue game. We've seen it other times this year. And this is an experienced team, too. Off the top of my head, I believe Northwestern brought back the most seniors of all the Big Ten teams this year. So, you know, when you're changing your offense and you go ahead and you decide that you're going to, you know, do some up-tempo things, you've got experienced players who are not going to get, you know, deer in the headlights look when they have to go on the field and do something different than they've done previous in their careers. They're already adjusted to Big Ten play, and experience certainly helps too.
In the last 6 years, Wisconsin has had some very good teams, some top 10 teams at the end of the season. But for whatever reason, there's always been this Northwestern bugaboo that the Badgers have had to deal with. Now, they haven't lost all of those games, but you look at the turnover battle in the last six games since 2014, Wisconsin has committed 20 turnovers against Northwestern. Could you, on any level, put your finger on how that happens to a good football team where they just have a thing about this particular school? Maybe it's the style of play. Maybe it's Coach Fitzgerald over there on the other sideline that's putting a voodoo hex on them or something. But whatever is going on in Evanston, it works against Wisconsin.
Well, I'll put part of this on the Northwestern defense because they're one of the best teams in the country again this year in getting turnovers. I believe they got 10 picks through the first four games. So they're very much a team that relies on getting turnovers. And their defensive coordinator, Mike Hankowitz, I believe he was at Wisconsin at one point in his career. He's been with Northwestern for a long, long time. Pat Fitzgerald talked about him earlier this season, the defensive coordinator Hankowitz. He's in his 70s, but he's got the energy of a 30-year-old. And the team really feeds off his style of defense. And part of Mike Hankowitz's defensive philosophy is you got to get turnovers. I know that's every defensive coordinator's dream, but Northwestern really emphasizes that. And so part of what the Badgers do, yeah, they've shot themselves in the foot. There's no doubt about it, thinking back to some of those past games. I mean, I'll take you back down memory lane, Doug. I was a student at Northwestern. I believe it was 1996. I was in Camp Randall Stadium. Barry Alvarez is the head coach of the Wisconsin Badgers. Wisconsin's got this game won, and I believe it was Ron Dane who fumbles the ball trying to run out the clock. And Northwestern gets the ball under Gary Barnett, and they go down and they score the game-winning touchdown. And me and three of my buddies are standing up cheering for Northwestern, and everybody in red is looking around at us, and we're like, okay, we're not going to get too loud here because there's 90,000 people who absolutely hate our guts and we do want to live to see tomorrow. But just, you know, taking back a generation to Wisconsin's troubles against Northwestern, maybe it's some of its luck, but I think part of it, too, is, yeah, the Badgers sometimes maybe playing to the Cats' hands, but the Cats really do emphasize turnovers. And also Northwestern in recent years has put some pretty good defensive teams on the field too. You know, at the start of the Fitzgerald era and even going back to the late Randy Walker, they really emphasized offense a lot. And sometimes the defense was like, oh my goodness, are you going to, you know, it's going to be a 59-50 shootout. And it's who touches the ball last, but that's not the case now. Northwestern really in recent years has been a defensive first team. So I think part of it is what Northwestern does to force those turnovers. You got to look at that angle, I think.
You want a fun fact?
Go for it.
The 1996 Badgers Wildcats game, that was my first year covering the Badgers for WTMJ. So I, too, was at the stadium at Camp Randall that day.
Wow, who would have thought? I never, you know, it's amazing how, you know, you got a future lifelong friend in the stadium, and, you know, we work together, or we've been friends for almost two decades now, and at that time in 1996, you were in the press box, I was with a few friends of mine as Northwestern students. One of my buddies is from Wisconsin, he's a lifelong friend too, and he got those tickets, and we're sitting really good, I want to say 35 or 40 yard line, and here I'm cheering for the Cats, you're covering that game for TMJ, and the next thing you know, later on in our careers would cross paths, and We've been friends ever since. But yeah, that was a great day to be a Northwestern fan. You know, Doug, I could still see it in my mind. It was a sunny day. I believe it was about mid-October that game was, I want to say. And it was, it was magical to be a student at Northwestern when that was going on because, I mean, they were doormats for so long. And I like to take some of the credit that when I was a student there, you know, I sat in that student section. I didn't play football, but I cheered for the Cats. And when I was there, things turned around. So I think Jason Gotch has got to take, you got to pat yourself on the back sometimes in life, you know?
I think you do. Jason Gotch, now of the Illinois Radio Network. He's their sports director, joining us here on the Doug Russell Podcast. Well, the anniversary of Ron Dayne breaking Ricky Williams' all-time NCAA rushing mark was, I think, last week. And I believe it was the 21st year, because, let's see, that happened in 99. So, yeah, it would have been 21 years. And sitting next to me in the press box that day was Mr. Cliff Saunders. And that was the first time I had ever met Mr. Cliff Saunders, who was working for One-on-One Sports at the time. I did not realize a couple of things. Number one, that I would be working with Cliff about 6 months later after I was hired to go to Northbrook and work at the network. And then Cliff and I have worked at the same place together in three different states. And he's the only person that I can say that about, that I have worked in three different states with at the time. So it's the magic of Camp Randall Stadium.
Yeah, that is really impressive. I did not. I knew you worked with Cliff, obviously, at Sporting News Radio. We all worked there together. I joined later. And then I knew you worked with him down in Houston. I didn't know there was a third state in the mix. I had no idea. See, you listen to the Doug Russell podcast, and you listen and you learn a lot. And our good friend Cliff, is he still down there doing work in Houston on the news side? Is that what his role is these days?
He is. He is at the iHeart radio station in Houston doing news. He works the morning shift. And I also work with him at WSSP in Milwaukee as well. So
that's right.
So I
work
with
right.
him in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Texas. So he's down there at KTRH. That's it. He's at KTRH. In Houston.
Good for Cliffy. Hard worker, real hard worker, and a good guy.
A radio lifer and a radio survivor, and God bless him. He's worked in a lot of different places, and he's really found a home in Houston. He's found a home in Texas, so good for him. And he's been down there for, gosh, almost a decade now. So, yeah, it's amazing what the press box at Camp Randall Stadium will bring. Of course, this game was supposed to be at Wrigley Field until, you know, the whole COVID mess changed everything in the world, not just in sports. How cool would this game have been if it were still allowed to be played at Wrigley Field in front of fans? That would have been
awesome.
Amazing.
Awesome. Would have been, you know, the way the Bears are playing, you guys up in Wisconsin, I'm sure you're laughing at the Bears again as we tape this podcast. They've lost four in a row. The Bulls are in a rebuild mode. The Blackhawks are in a rebuild mode. You know, baseball season's over. So this would have been the ticket. I mean, you think about it, so many Badgers fans were so close to that Wisconsin border, plus a lot of Badgers alum and Wisconsin folks settling in the Chicago area. When Northwestern's good down here, Doug, people care. When they're not good, you know, they don't care. Let's be honest about it. As a Cats alum, I hate to say that, but for Northwestern, for people that care in the Chicago area about Northwestern, they got to be good. And if they were coming in this game with a chance at the Big Ten title, it would be a hot ticket. I remember in, I believe it was 2009, Northwestern played Illinois, if you recall, at Wrigley Field. And that was the game where they decided right before, the day before the game on a Friday, that it wasn't safe to go both directions because
I remember
because the outfield wall in right field and where the third base dugout is, there's just not enough room to go ahead and, you know, have enough comfort zone beyond the back line of the end zone. So both teams went the same way. But as I'm sure all your listeners know, Wrigley Field has been completely redone. And one of the things they did when they remade Wrigley Field on the inside and outside and renovated the thing is they said, we want to make this where we can play football games in here, college level. I don't think you'll ever see an NFL game, but college games in there. And that's what they've done. So this would have been awesome. I mean, this would have been a hot ticket. It would have been a sellout. It would have been, you wouldn't have got in for, you know, under probably a couple $100 any seat for this game. But, you know, it's the era we live in. You got to bounce through it. It's going to be in Evanston. Hopefully in future years they'll be able to reschedule not only the Badgers, Northwestern, but other teams playing at Wrigley, because as I said, Northwestern's good. You're going to get a lot of interest in the Chicago area. They're not good, not as much. But a game at Wrigley Field's always a novelty, so that can kind of give that Cats program each and every year if they can find a way to make that happen, or even every couple of years, kind of a shot in the arm going forward.
Well, Notre Dame and Wisconsin were supposed to play this year at Lambeau Field in Green Bay. Obviously, that got scrapped as well, but the I guess reverse game, if it's a home and home, the home being for the Badgers, actually it would have technically been at Soldier Field for whatever reason, and the home game for Notre Dame would have been at Lambeau Field. I don't know why they designated it that, but that would have been great as well. But that leads me to another question. Right now, Northwestern is good. Notre Dame's having a great season as well. Here in Chicago, is Chicago right now a Notre Dame town, or is it a Northwestern town?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm not normally stumped when I get a question, Doug, but that's a good one because just to take you back, I mean, if you asked me this question 20 years ago, even if Northwestern was when they were good, let's go 25 years ago when they were competing, when they were winning a Big Ten title and playing USC in the Rose Bowl, I would have said, well, for 1 year, Doug, this is a Northwestern town because they're going to the Rose Bowl. And I mean, that was the biggest story. It was on the news. It was huge. It was Hollywood. It was every. It was right out of, you know, a Disney movie that they could make that into. But in any other year, it was Notre Dame, and Notre Dame by a mile. Notre Dame, no offense to Irish fans listening, it's just not the same. College football has changed so much, and Notre Dame is still a marquee program, but they're not competing for national championships each and every year. And when they've had the chance to be in the college football playoff, they've gotten hammered in some of those games by some teams from the South. So it's not the same as it used to be, but I would still give the edge to Notre Dame a little bit just because the Chicago area, it's such a Catholic city and a Catholic area. There's a lot of people that are practice the Roman Catholic religion here. And for Catholics, Notre Dame is everything. I mean, it's Notre Dame. It's the biggest Catholic university in the world where people want to go to Notre Dame. So for that reason and for Notre Dame's legacy, I would say, yeah, Notre Dame probably has more fans here right now. There's more interest in Notre Dame. But again, that changes when Northwestern's good because all of a sudden that idea that Northwestern's Chicago's Big Ten team, people embrace that. But all things being equal, I would say Notre Dame has the edge, but not what they had a generation ago. It's a little bit closer now.
And yet they still let a kid named Patty Fisher out of their sights so he could come to Northwestern. How does that work?
Yeah, you think about that. I mean, Pat Fitzgerald went, you know, he's from Orland Park. He went to Sandberg High School, I believe. I mean, and for anybody who knows geography, Chicago and South Bend, you know, that suburb is, you know, south of Chicago. So you're even closer to South Bend. Yeah, I mean, you could hop in the car and probably be there in a little over an hour. But one of those things, Lou Holtz didn't see Pat Fitzgerald as a guy who fit into his program at the time. And Northwestern did. And the next thing you know, it's history. I mean, Pat Fitzgerald looks like he's going to be a Northwestern lifer. And for good reason. He's done such a great job with that program. I mean, he took over in 2006 when Randy Walker tragically passed away over the summer. And with that opportunity, he's really put his stamp on the Northwestern program. And you look at what he does in most years. I know last year was a down year, but Northwestern's won 3 straight bowl games. A few years ago, they were in the Music City Bowl. They beat Kentucky. Then they had a good win in the Holiday Bowl a couple of years ago on New Year's Eve against Utah. So Northwestern, I like to look at it this way, Doug. I don't put them on the same plane necessarily as Wisconsin because I think the Badgers in a real good year have an outside chance, you know, competing for the national championship. I don't see that right now for Northwestern. But as far as Big Ten teams that you don't think about realistically ever having a national championship chance at it, you know, I would say that Northwestern's as good as any of those teams in that category. So they're not Ohio State, Penn State, or Michigan, or even Wisconsin. But any of those other teams you think about, I mean, I'll put Iowa in there, Nebraska, Minnesota, obviously Illinois, they're better than Illinois, Indiana, Purdue, Maryland, they're better than Rutgers, you know, Michigan State even I'll throw in there. They're as good as any of those teams as far as a Big Ten program over the last decade or more.
Well, I was going to ask you next about Pat Fitzgerald because, you know, the circumstances in which he got the job, I mean, he was always kind of the heir apparent, but Randy Walker's heart attack kind of pushed things to the forefront. But there was a thought in Green Bay, and I don't know if it was more than something that ever got out of the rumor phase. But after Mike McCarthy got fired a couple of years ago, I mean, Mark Murphy, the former AD at Northwestern, now the Packers president and CEO, there was that connection. Then there was a thought that Pat Fitzgerald, if he ever wanted to make the move to the NFL, the Packers would be a perfect fit for him. But I don't know, with all apologies to Paul Christ, and maybe it's one and 1A, but I don't see a better fit for a program. And again, Paul Christ is a Wisconsin lifer, grew up in Madison, went to the University of Wisconsin, played at the University of Wisconsin. But I look at Pat Fitzgerald, and I think if you cut him open, he bleeds Northwestern purple. I mean, he embodies Northwestern football, and I just don't see him ever coaching anywhere else. And I don't see the university ever coming to him and saying, I just don't see the scenario. You know what? You've had a couple of losing seasons. I think we need to make a change. I think you're right. I think he's a lifer there from his perspective as well as the school's.
Yeah, I don't see it any differently, Doug, except maybe does Pat Fitzgerald ever get the itch and say, you know, I really want a shot to win a national championship, and I don't see that happening at Northwestern. So I'm going to take, if one of those real marquee jobs opened up, let's say Saban retires and Alabama opens up. I'm not saying he'd be a candidate. He probably wouldn't be. Dabo Sweeney's probably the guy there if he wants that job, but who knows if he wants to leave Clemson. Let's say Clemson opens up. And after that, I mean, there's a few jobs that Ohio State he would not take. That's a rivalry against North. He would not go to another Big Ten school. I do not believe that. I don't think that's in the cards. It'd have to be somebody Northwestern didn't play. But there's not many schools like that. I don't think he'd take the USC job. I mean, they've been down for a long time. I know you're a USC guy. you don't like Clay Helton? Come on. I mean, there's a guy that needs to go. But yeah, I know a lot of programs will be blessed to have Pat Fitzgerald. I agree with you. I think he stays. That would be the only scenario. Or let's say an NFL job did open up and he wanted a new challenge. But you know what? You think about the Northwestern job if you're Pat Fitzgerald. Okay, the idea of competing for national championships and trying to win them, you know, every year, every other year, that's got to be alluring for any coach because you want to be on the ultimate level. Coaching in the NFL, I don't know if his act would work in the NFL. I don't say act in a mean way, but Pat Fitzgerald is very much a rah-rah college football team family type of coach. He gets people to buy in. It's different in the NFL. The NFL is a job. It's not necessarily a passion. It's a job for those guys. I mean, you can wear a 49ers jersey today, and tomorrow you can go ahead and you can wear a Bears jersey, and the next year you can wear a Dolphins jersey, and that's just part of it. It's not the same passion as you have for your college or college program. So I don't know if it would even work in the NFL. But you think about living what the life Pat Fitzgerald has. Northwestern pays him very well. There's never been a contract dispute. It's a private school that can certainly afford to pay him. You live in Chicago. I know the weather's not good here. It's the third largest city in the country. There's a lot of advantages of living in the Chicago area. He's from here. His family put roots down here generations ago. He, like you said, his job is 100% safe. I think he could have three or four losing seasons, and the seat wouldn't be all that hot for him. I think it would really have to get bad, and I don't think it will, because he's proven he can coach very well. And even when Northwestern's had a down year, like last year, 3-9, he shakes up his staff. He's not normally known as a guy who does that, but he did it on offense. He brought in a Ramsey, the quarterback, and all of a sudden here they are with a chance to win the Big Ten West. So I don't see losing consistently in the Big Ten as something that Pat Fitzgerald's going to have to go through. Losing here and there, but not where it's the bottom's going to fall out. So there's a lot of advantages for him and his family to keep this job, you know, as long as he wants it until he retires. Because look, being the coach at Northwestern the way Pat Fitzgerald is right now, that's a pretty darn good spot he's in. And if you leave that spot, it's the old phrase, we've always heard it, the grass is not always greener on the other side. And look, the grass is really green for Pat Fitzgerald right now at Northwestern.
Yeah, amen to that. Jason Gotch from the Illinois Radio Network, their sports director. A couple more minutes with him here on the Doug Russell Podcast. Final thing for you, Jason. What do you expect to see on Saturday when Northwestern has the ball from their offense? And what do you expect their defense to do in response to Wisconsin's offense?
Well, I'll talk about the defense first, because I really think that what they have to do, when you look at this defense, they obviously you want to force turnovers. You really have to try and force turnovers. But they need to get to Mertz, the quarterback. They really need to put pressure on him. They may need to make life uncomfortable for him. He's a young guy. Wisconsin has not played a lot of games, as you know, the COVID situation, forcing the Badgers to miss a few games here early in the season. So you got a quarterback who's played real well in a couple games, but his experience level is not to what you would have for a veteran Big Ten quarterback at this point. So force turnovers ideally, but get to the quarterback on defense. That's a must for Northwestern to make life uncomfortable on that Badgers offense. And offensively, it's key for Peyton Ramsey, the quarterback, to protect the football. But I think you'll see a lot of Drake Anderson running the football, Northwestern mixing in some opportunistic passes, some shorter passes, a spread-type offense to try and spread the ball around the field, maybe take some deep shots, but really try and grind that clock, run the football, win the turnover battle. Because on paper, Northwestern's, they're an underdog in this game. I think last time I looked, it was 7.5. So the odds makers think that Wisconsin's a better team on paper, and I think they are. On paper, they're a better team. But I wouldn't bet against Northwestern here. It wouldn't surprise me at all, Doug, if they won this game. But they got to do a couple things, like I said. Get to the quarterback, run the football pretty well, don't turn over the ball, and do what you talked about, again, on those turnovers. You said it. Over the years, the Badgers have had rough games against Northwestern. They haven't protected the ball well. If that happens in this one, I think Northwestern's in a pretty good spot. Now, I really do think this is the game for the Big Ten West title at this point. So whoever wins this one's probably headed to Indy in mid-December, and the loser's probably headed to a decent bowl game. But unfortunately, if Northwestern loses this one, I don't see him winning the Big Ten West.
Kickoff is at Ryan Field in Evanston at 2:30 on Saturday. You can watch it on ABC if you're in the Milwaukee area on Channel 12. But if you're listening somewhere else, you can watch it on ABC television wherever you happen to be. Jason Gotch, sports director from the Illinois Radio Network, kind enough to spend a few minutes with us here on the Doug Russell podcast previewing the big game as the balance of power in the Big Ten West is on the line for the Badgers as well as the Wildcats. Jason, as always, appreciate the time so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Doug, always a pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving to you, your listeners, your family, and gobble, gobble. We'll talk again real soon.
Sounds good. We appreciate it. And yeah, we will. You had to go gobble, gobble because you know I hate turkey.
Come on. You know I'm an instigator. Hey, you're on the radio, too. You know, you like to push those buttons. I know you're the only person in America that doesn't like turkey. I know you're really not. I know you're really not, Doug. I know you don't like turkey. You're going to have pizza on Thanksgiving. I can't believe that. Oh, my goodness. It does not sound good to me. But, hey, to each their own. If it makes you happy and your family's good with it, I guess, who am I to complain, right?
Well,
but
you're
for
half,
me,
you're
gobble,
half
gobble.
Right there. You're half right there. It makes me happy. I don't know about anybody else. But, anyway, gobble, gobble to you, and we will talk to you again soon.
All right. Look forward to it, Doug. Have a great one.
Thanks, Jason. You too. There he goes. Jason Gotch from the Illinois Radio Network. Some other big games to keep your eyes on this weekend from the college ranks on the other side of the Big Ten and the Big Ten East. It still seems strange to say this, but I'm just going to go ahead. Number 9, Indiana at number 3, Ohio State. That is an early kickoff on Saturday, an 11 a.m. kickoff for whatever reason. That should be in prime time. One game that is in prime time, they call it Bedlam. Oklahoma State taking on Oklahoma. The Cowboys, number 14 in the country. The Sooners, number 18. That's a 6:30 kickoff. A 3 o'clock kickoff, top-ranked Alabama playing host to Kentucky. And Utah finally playing their first game of the season. They'll play host to 20th-ranked USC. That will kick off Wisconsin time at 9:30. Moving on to the NFL, the Packers take on the Colts on Sunday. It's no secret. The key to Green Bay's success, and for that matter, most teams in the NFL's success, is pressuring the other team's quarterback. On Sunday, Philip Rivers, a likely future Hall of Famer, stands in front of Matt LaFleur's front seven.
Anytime you're playing a talented offensive line with a Hall of Fame quarterback and his ability to get the ball out of his hands, it does present a challenge. And I just think the mentality is you have to be relentless up front and you can't get frustrated and you got to keep attacking it because you just never know. We're going to have to be sticky on the back end in order to get home, take away some of those initial reads. So Philip has has to maybe hold it a little bit longer than he'd like to, but it's just got to be an attacking, aggressive, relentless mentality from our pass rushers.
Phillip Rivers, in his first season in Indianapolis after 16 with the Chargers, he's sixth all-time on the career touchdowns thrown list.
I think one of his best traits in just watching him over the years is just the competitiveness that he has. I think it rubs off on everybody. It's infectious. He's such a great leader, and he knows how to get the ball out of his hands. I mean, there's times when you watch that pocket collapse and it's going down around him, and he knows exactly where to go with the football. He always seems to find the hole in the defense, and that's what he did to us last year. You know, when the opportunities presented themselves, he made throws down the field, and when he needed to get it out quickly, he was able to do that. So we know that he is one of the all-time greats, and you know, it's going to be a great challenge for our defense.
So Phillip Rivers is sixth on the passing touchdowns list. Seventh, for what it's worth, is Aaron Rodgers. He's having one of his best seasons and thinks the sky's the limit when everyone, including wide receiver Alan Lazard, is healthy.
I think so. I mean, you know, Marquez has had a couple of good games in a row. Devontae's obviously been incredible. To be able to have Alan in there as well would give us a big jolt. You know, Bobby's been having a good season. Love Mercedes and having our two backs. You know, like I said earlier, I feel like, you know, we're kind of back to our week one if we could get everybody back. I think Alan is an X factor for us, because as much as he's, you know, done really good in the first 3 weeks catching the ball, he's such a great run blocker. And I think that's some stuff we've been missing with a lot of the things that we'd like to do in the run game, is not being able to have Allen front side or some of the backside stuff that we do with him. So if we can get him back, obviously I think it would help not just in the passing game, but run the football too.
But the Colts defense is stout, good against the run and the pass. Aaron has been able to find his receivers for the most part, but the ground game has been stuck in neutral for the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, you know, we had a couple games early in the season where we really ran the ball well, and we got to get back to controlling the line of scrimmage a little more. In the meantime, you know, I think we've been throwing it pretty well. Got to keep finding ways to get certain guys involved. You know, not sure what Allen's status will be this week and Devontae, but hopefully those guys will be able to go, and we'll kind of look a little more like we did in week one.
Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers. From the Friday practice report, Devontae Adams, Alan Lazard, Kevin King, and Jair Alexander all were able to practice on Friday. The bad news, Tyler Irvin and Montrevious Adams, neither one were able to practice with Indianapolis looming on Sunday. So how good is this Colts team anyway? Well, they're 6-3, we know that. They lead the tiebreaker for the top spot in the AFC South. Joining me now to take a deeper look at the Colts, a longtime friend. He's one of the great hosts on 107.5 The Fan in Indianapolis. Jeff Ricker joins us here on the Doug Russell Podcast. Jeff, it's great to talk to you again.
It's good to not only see you again, but speak with you again. It's always good.
Absolutely. First of all, I think a lot of Wisconsinites, maybe a lot of the listeners to this podcast, would like to know, how's our guy Jonathan Taylor doing?
Jonathan Taylor's gone in fits and starts. You know, there's certainly potential there. You guys saw it all the time. If he can turn the corner and get an open field, he's got speed to go along with it. It seems like he struggled at times just picking up blocking schemes and reading the blocking schemes correctly. I think of a little bit of a different system than maybe he used at Wisconsin. And Frank Reich likes to spread the ball around. He likes to give touches to Nyheim Hines. He likes Jordan Wilkins to come in for a little while. He even uses his tight ends on kind of little end around plays a lot. I think I saw it today, if you include the two quarterbacks, 17 different Colts have touched the football this year. And Jonathan Taylor is a guy that they think has huge upside. They still love him. I know he had the fumbling issue at Wisconsin. He's only had one so far in his NFL career through nine games now. He's just kind of caught right now in the ultimate timeshare. Like if you are into fantasy football, you hate Frank Reich, because he's just one of those guys like Bill Belichick. He's going to change the game plan all the time, and nobody's probably going to get more than 15 touches a game, and that person is going to vary from game to game, and that's just the way Frank likes it.
Phillip Rivers, 16 years with the Chargers, his first year in Indianapolis. Can you teach an old dog new tricks? How's he fitting in Indy?
I don't think that they expected to teach an old dog new tricks, just take care of the football. You know, when Phillip has done that in his career, he's had a lot of success. I mean, he really has. The biggest difference, if you look at statistically, between he and Aaron Rodgers is that he's turned the ball over quite a bit more over the course of his career than Aaron. Their completion percentages are pretty close. The things that they've accomplished statistically are pretty close, except for, as you know, Aaron Rodgers is just great at not turning the football over, and Phillip Rivers has had a problem with that at times. Been pretty good about that with the Colts so far this year. I don't think that they brought him in to say, Phillip, you got to go win us a bunch of games, but they need him to make good decisions, and they've tried to surround him with people that can make plays. And over the last three, If you look at their season-long stats, it's a little bit deceiving. You'll say, well, where are their playmakers? But if you look at the last three games, Nyheim Hines, the rookie Michael Pittman Jr., they have really started to emerge. He's got a great set of tight ends that he likes to use that pretty much equally like everybody else. But you can see over the last three games that offense is becoming more and more what Frank Reich would like an offense to be as opposed to the first six games.
Of course, the bread and butter for this Indianapolis Colts team is made on the other side of the ball. Some big changes came to the Colts this year. Guys like DeForest Buckner, somebody certainly the Packers fans are familiar with from the NFC North, from the Minnesota Vikings, Xavier Rhodes at cornerback. How have those guys fit in? Because, man, I tell you what, this Colts defense looks legit.
Yeah, they are legit. I'll leave it to Justin Houston, who will tell you that DeForest Buckner is a man. That's coming from Justin Houston, okay? He's incredibly strong. He's required double teams. You've got a scheme for him. They got Darius Leonard running around right behind him, which was tremendous. If they could just get their entire defensive line healthy, much like your running back core, you keep thinking, man, if we could get all these guys healthy at the same time. I mean, it's the same thing with their defensive front line. Buckner has been healthy all year long, but they've had trouble with getting Kamiko Touré in. They've got some other injury concerns, some sickness this week that I don't know any more than that, other than a couple guys missed practice because they were sick and not feeling well, but I haven't seen anybody show up on COVID reserve or anything like that yet. It's just a matter of staying healthy. They fortified the secondary. They brought in a guy you know well, Xavier Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in TJ Carey, who's been tremendous as a fill-in nickelback and just wherever they needed to plug him in. The rookie that they picked from Utah, they got in the fourth round, Julian Blackman, who probably, if he wasn't coming off an ACL, might have been a first rounder. He's going to be a stud. I mean, he's only played a few games, and he's raised eyebrows already. He's a free safety that is not afraid to hit. And he covers a lot of ground, and he plays very well. And I just – there's a reason that they are overall, I think, number two in the NFL right now, right behind a team that you guys know well, Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm.
They are third in points allowed behind only the Rams and the Steelers. And I think they are second in interceptions right now. So they've been taking the ball away. They've got 11 of those through nine games. So it still doesn't feel like it's complete, but they have played pretty well at times. They've kept the Colts in some games and they've helped win some games for them. And in the last three games, as I said, the offense is starting to kind of come around.
Now, one of the two losses that the Packers have to that team that you just mentioned, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the only game that they really weren't competitive in this year, which leads me to the Colts right now at 6-3, opening week loss to Jacksonville. Obviously, they've had their struggles. Wins against Minnesota, I think they're starting to play well, but in week two, they were an awful, dysfunctional football team. Beat up on the Jets. Everybody's beaten up on the Jets. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Bears, they have been a roller coaster this year. Losses at Cleveland, then a win against Cincinnati. You see where I'm going with this. The knock on, I think the Colts has been, you haven't really beaten anybody until last week against Tennessee. How important was that game for maybe the legitimacy internally and externally for this team?
Internally, I think they've always felt pretty good about where they're at, that they just hadn't, as I said, hit on all cylinders yet. You know, they're putting together a lot of new faces this past year. And I think they thought it might take a little bit of time, especially with the weird year that we've had. But yeah, there's no denying that they had the easiest schedule through 7 weeks in the National Football League. I think for them to beat Tennessee on the road, even though what does that mean on the road now?
Right.
You're playing at a different facility. There's not 75,000, 80,000 people screaming at you all of a sudden. But it was important for them. But here's the other thing, too. You know how there are franchises that just own other franchises. Doesn't seem to matter who the quarterback is. Doesn't matter what the defense is doing. Jacksonville has always been that for the Colts. I don't know why. They've just really played the Colts well. And they beat them in week one inexplicably. I mean, it's a bad team that Jacksonville gave Green Bay all they wanted a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the Colts have just always had the Titans number over the last two decades. Now, a lot of that was Peyton Manning and Andrew Luck. I get you, but they beat them a lot. And so they're both 6-3 and the Colts, because of the head to head now, are in first place in the AFC South. And still to come in this stretch, they had Tennessee, they have Green Bay this week, Tennessee next week. They still have to play Pittsburgh later on this year. They got to still play twice against the divisional Houston Texans, who I think, even though aren't a great team, Deshaun Watson can turn it on at any time. So you got to worry about that. So the tough part of their schedule is definitely coming right now. And it's a big game for them against Green Bay. It's a really important game for them to kind of, as you suggest, point out to themselves who they are.
Well, you mentioned that some teams just have other teams' numbers. You know, the Packers have never won in Indianapolis,
which is crazy. And I know they only play here once every, what, however often.
Years,
they only
think.
Play each other every 4 years anyway, and then you alternate that. So, yeah, once every 8 years, I wouldn't make a ton out of that. It's just kind of how that's worked out over time. And I think the last time they played was a guy named Peyton Manning that was playing for him, too. Although
I've heard of him.
Favre? Was it Favre or Rodgers the last time they played?
That would have been Rodgers. Rodgers has been a starter now for, I think, 11 years.
Yeah, I was looking some stuff up with him, he and Rivers, and I can't believe Aaron's 35 going on 36.
No, 36 going on 37.
36 going on 37? Yeah. And
they'll be 37 in 2 weeks.
And Rivers is 2 years older than him.
Yeah.
Rodgers doesn't play like a guy that age, though, right now. He still doesn't to me. He's still amazing to watch. He's mobile when he needs to be. He's elusive in the pocket. He's got an incredible pocket sense. His arm is as good as anybody still. His accuracy is off the charts. He's Aaron Rodgers. I don't have to tell you. I
mean, it's all that yoga that he does.
It's whatever he does. It works out on Sundays, usually.
Definitely. One question that I think a lot of people are interested in is because the Packers, when they haven't had any fans in the stands, have come out flat. And Wisconsin being a hot spot for COVID-19, there haven't been any fans in the stands at Lambeau Field. I don't think there are going to be the way things are going right now. I remember that Notre Dame game a few weeks ago where the fans swarmed the field in South Bend. Number one, what's been the fallout to that, and has that affected what we're going to see on Sunday? Not that fans are going to swarm the field, but how many fans are going to be at Lucas Oil Stadium?
So for a couple of games in a row now, they have allowed 12,500 in. Where my seats are when I take my family, if I'm not working, we're kind of in the corner on an end zone on the press box side, about halfway up the first section. And the way they've done it at Lucas Oil is any seats that they have not sold, those 12,500, they're literally tied down with zip ties. You cannot use the seats in any way, shape, or form. We have four seats together. There's a row between us and the next group behind us, and then they're offset from that. So we were comfortable going. Everybody was great about getting in line and socially distancing 6-8 feet. We never came within really close proximity of anybody else, and people were required to wear masks unless they happened to be eating their hot dog or whatever. And so at no time did we ever feel like we were, you know, in a tough spot. So 12,500, that's where they've been sitting at right now. They'll look at it again after this game and see where we are, because you've seen the maps. The entire Midwest is just dark orange or red, and I don't think that's going to change in the next couple of weeks. But so far, so good at Lucas Oil Stadium. I don't think there's anything that's been traced back to that kind of a gathering, because for the most part, it's been pretty well regulated there.
Has there been any fallout from the Notre Dame fans swarming when they won a couple weeks ago?
As you know, the thing about Notre Dame, too, is it's about 2 hours north of Indianapolis. It's really more Chicagoland than it is Indianapolis. And I know that some Notre Dame officials were kind of, you know, face-palming themselves and saying, what's going on here? Why do we let them do that? But I also know that Notre Dame had their big outbreaks in the summer and at the beginning of football season. I almost can't help but wonder if most of the people that were on that field had already had it at some point in time. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't heard any huge fallout down here from that, other than just the visual of, oh, that's going to work out well for everybody.
Jeff Rickard got it up to spend a few minutes with us from the fan in Indianapolis. It's the Packers taking on the Colts at Lucas Oil Stadium coming up on Sunday afternoon. Jeff, final question for you is, I know you had a hard episode about a year ago. What did you learn from that? And boy, you've been really outspoken in public about it, and kudos to you for that. But I don't like the fact that a dear friend of mine had a really, really tough time with this thing.
Well, I had the average ordinary heart attack, if there is such a thing, and they were putting a stent in. And what they didn't realize when they were putting the stent in is that they had nicked my artery in the heart, and I bled out into my heart sac during recovery in the recovery room, and I was on and off with a heartbeat for about 30 minutes. The longest time was 26 minutes, I think. But they finally got me back, got me stabilized, got me to a higher level trauma unit downtown via helicopter. I don't remember any of that stuff. I woke up 3 days later just really weak. And, you know, as you know, I've been kind of an athlete and a cyclist and a football player my whole life. And it took me a while to get everything back, but you know, a year later, I feel like I'm as close to 100% as I could be right now. But my message has been, I kept thinking for a year or two after that, I need to go get my heart scan. Just check this out and make sure I'm okay. There's a little bit of a history of it in my family. I eat well. I have a good exercise plan, good diet. But genetics are undefeated, man. And even you might not realize you are genetically predisposed for having heart problems. Once you get to be 35, 40, most insurance covers the bulk of it. Go get a heart scan. Get yourself checked. Make sure you're okay. I could have avoided all of that day, perhaps, if I'd have known a little bit more about what was going on inside me and how to take care of it. And the other thing I learned is, as we're learning during this pandemic, man, please don't take the hospital workers for granted. I'm telling you, these nurses, these doctors, these orderlies, these physician's assistants that work 12, 14-hour shifts most days, the level of care that I received was just unbelievable. So take care of yourself, get your heart checked, and respect the people that keep us all going and keep us alive, especially right now. Those are the three things that I've really felt like it's now my calling to go out and share with people. So
here.
Thanks for asking.
Absolutely. Jeff Rickard, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it. You're a good friend, and we will talk again soon, I hope.
One question for you before I get out of here, because my people down here won't let me hear the end of it if I don't. Are we going to see Devontae Adams on Sunday or not?
I don't know. I think so. He's been in and out of the lineup for the last couple of years. He had a toe injury last year and he missed four games.
He shows up when he shows up, though, man. He plays.
He does. And when he's out there, man, he's as good as any wide receiver, I think, in the NFL. He's certainly a top five guy. He proclaimed himself to be the number one guy. And last week had a little bit of a rough game, dropped a couple of passes and had an uncharacteristic fumble. Well, yeah, but he wasn't hurt in his arms to, you know, keep the ball.
But he made the play that counted, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he went up and he got it. And that's what everybody remembers in Green Bay. And all the other stuff is forgotten. So,
well,
I think we'll see him on Sunday.
I'm one of those guys that wants to see the best all the time. So I hope he's healthy and ready to go.
Definitely. Absolutely. Should be a good game. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
There he goes. Jeff Rickard from 107.5 The Fan in Indianapolis. That's it for the weekend edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on the social medias, Instagram and Twitter. Our username is the same. It is @DougRussellPod. Search for the Doug Russell Podcast on Facebook and YouTube. And you can email us at DougRussellPod@gmail.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.